A moment of mental editing. Felix Vodyanov was delusional and dishonest. Explain that. Here's an example. He liked custom-made clothing he couldn't afford, so he shopped resale. You know what I'm talking about? Stores where high-end items are sold on consignment? Slidell probably didn't, but nodded. Then he'd cut out the labels so no one would know. Aiello smoothed down the front of his shirt. He'd buy cheap tobacco and transfer it to fancy European packaging.
I got a nephew's pretentious like that. Don't make him a perv.
Vodyanov was also paranoid. He'd pay only in cash, had no credit cards, no cell phone, constantly created and abandoned internet accounts. He went through aliases like the rest of us go through tissue.
Where'd he live?
I don't know. At Deep Haven, one does not query the personal lives of others.
Yet he told you where he bought his skivvies.
I certainly didn't ask.
The guy have a job?
He did research for bodies, blogs, and podcasts. Apparently, little bro was too cheap to support the lifestyle to which big bro aspired.
Why'd you clock him?
I told you, I was defending myself.
Why'd he jump you?
It's a long story.
I'm listening.
Very deep sigh. Early last month, people started reporting that someone was looking for me. I had no idea who or why.
People?
Neighbors, a client, the gardener.
Go on.
One day I saw a man on the sidewalk outside my home. He was just standing there, staring at the house. It was Felix Vodyanov. Flashback. A face lit by a street lamp in a parking lot at Sharon Hall.
What did he want?
Aiello's fingers interlaced, tightened so hard they paled. Discomfort with the upcoming part of the story. He used to ask me questions about kids. I don't know why he was interested or why he chose me.
What kids?
Missing kids. Slidell again jabbed the Cole photo, now back on the table. Aiello nodded. And others.
What others?
I don't recall names.
Don't jerk me around.
I'm not. Aiello was sweating visibly now. His skin looked silky yellow through the filter of the mirror. More than once, he accused me of kidnapping and molesting children, of being behind those disappearances.
What made him think that?
The man was insane.
And there's that pesky arrest record you got.
I was never convicted. Churlish. Everyone misunderstands. Viewing images does not equate to hurting children.
Go on.
I couldn't see Slidell's face, but knew he was struggling to control his temper. For a while he dropped the whole subject. Then, as I said, maybe 6 weeks ago, he started this stalking business. When I saw him outside my home, I confronted him. He said he'd come to force me to level with him, to tell him what happened to these kids. I told him to go screw himself. He tried again at Deep Haven. That's when I hit him. Slidell looked at Aiello a very long moment, then,
"Don't move."
"I really must." Slidell gathered his papers, got to his feet, and crossed to the door. I met him in the hall.
"What do you think?"
Wiping his face with a grayed square of fabric yanked from a back pocket. He never asked how Vodyanov died.
"You notice that, too."
"Still, my gut says he's telling the truth."
"But not all of it."
"Exactly." The hands on the wall clock were pointing to the 12 and the 5. "Listen, I still have some cleaning up to do and a file to collect and read before my testimony next week."
"Go."
Pocket jamming the hanky.
"I'll trot this wanker through his story a couple more times, see if it hangs together when he's balls to the wall."
A wave of hot, humid air engulfed me when I left the building, slogged me across the lot to my car. I was at the MCME in minutes. The lobby was almost empty, not unusual for a Wednesday afternoon in July. An elderly woman slouched in a chair, crying quietly into a lavender tissue. The death investigator stood flipping through pages on a clipboard. I swiped my card, passed through the bio-vestibule to the secure side of the facility, and went straight to my office. No sign of Hevner. Mixed feelings about that. Part of me wanted to confront her. Another part wanted to avoid another skirmish with Dr. Death. Once at my desk, I logged onto my computer and checked my mail. Nothing from Lamange. I busied myself with other messages and requests, other tasks. The Pascarol file finally arrived around 4. After downloading and printing the relevant portions, I logged off and headed out. I made a not-so-quick stop at the vet's office to pick up a case of Birdie's preferred food, apparently stored in a warehouse in suburban Dubrovnik. I was back at the annex by 5. After a glass of sun tea, which I'd brought in from outside and placed in the fridge, I opened the Pascarol file and sorted the components into stacks at the kitchen table. I was reviewing my skeletal autopsy report when Dorothée Pascarol opened the back door. Chapter 26. Thursday, July 12th. Sounds eddied around me. A cacophony of beeping and clanking and humming and ringing. And voices, most hushed. One forceful, frenzied almost. I smelled climatized air and disinfectant. My head pounded. My chest burned. My forearm prickled. I tried to sit up, felt pressure on my shoulders, gentle but firm. I lay back.
She's awake.
Footsteps clicked hard and fast. I opened my eyes. Light scorched my optic nerves like a jolt from a taser. A face hovered above me, a landscape of foggy valleys and peaks. Slowly, the geography crystallized into a recognizable pattern.
You're gonna be just dandy, Doc.
Forced calm, belying tension. I could only stare at Slidell, unable to speak.
I rang for the nurse, then bellowed over one shoulder. Where's the goddamn nurse?
Drink? My mouth was as dry as an unwatered lawn in August. Slidell conferred with someone, got clearance. A plastic tumbler was produced. I sucked on the straw like I'd never drunk liquid before. Flash synapses. Dorothée Pascarol backlit in my doorway. Standing at my car, flies buzzing and dive-bombing the fenders and hood.
What time? Almost 4.
Jesus Christ. Could that be? When I tried rewinding a mental tape of the afternoon, my brain unspooled a mashup of visual, tactile, and olfactory impressions. Images of a jarringly blue path winding through psychedelically green vegetation toward an open blast door leading to a pitch-black void. A tiny green beacon beckoning me through an endless warren of ebony darkness. My fingers brailing over concrete furry with moss, convoluted piping, metal fittings vomiting rust. My nose sorting primordial smells, moldy earth, rotting fabric, and creatures long dead. Had I gone to Cleveland County? Had I descended into Vodyanov's bunker? Slidell read my confusion.
It's 4 a.m., Thursday morning. You were AWOL for almost 10 hours.
Was that possible?
What happened? I croaked. A guy walking his poodle found you outside by the back wall at Sharon Hall. Harcourt, that's the guy, claims Larry, that's the poodle, was sniffing for a leak, nosed you out under a hedge. Thinking you were either drunk or dead, Harcourt called 911. That was around 2 a.m. Don't ask me why the dog needed to piss at that hour of the morning.
Nervous run-on, Slidell was clearly wired.
Harcourt says he's willing to do interviews. Not sure about Larry.
Had I spent that long wandering the grounds or curled up outside? Had I driven to Cleveland County, eventually returned and passed out by the wall? Had someone taken me there, then brought me back home? Was it all the result of a cataclysmic headache? Meds? I didn't remember taking anything. A sign of deterioration of escalating symptoms? A stroke? I hadn't a clue. My memories were like flakes in a blizzard, battered and spun by the wind, then left to melt in my head. Vivid, detailed, yet surreal. A Hiroshima of garish chaos. How did you know?
I swung by your place around 8 last night to brief you on some news. Found your door wide open, your purse on the counter, your wheels in the drive. I waited a bit thinking maybe you was out jogging, but that seemed off, even with the lone gunslinger act you've been peddling lately. I called in a bolo, eventually got word the EMTs had brought you here.
My cat?
Already pissed when I showed up. I fed him.
The curtain warped on its little metal rings. A nurse strode into the bay. Her name was Georgia. She looked like El Chapo having a bad day. Georgia checked a printout, a drip bottle, the beeping machines, crossed to me. ER? Stupid question.
That's right, honey. We're bringing you down easy.
I have an embolized aneurysm, and I suffer from migraines. I might have taken something if I felt a headache coming on. Georgia took my pulse. Her fingers felt strong and cool.
Whatever you knocked back left no trace.
My last conscious memories were fragmentary. The fire, the Aiello interrogation, the Pascarol file, the heat, the sun tea. Crap. Might that be it? The jar had remained outside far too long. Might something have contaminated the tea? Might someone have tampered with it? The burglar arsonist? I don't do drugs. Absurd, but I felt an overpowering need to convince Georgia of my innocent role in the overdose.
Whatever. You're gonna live.
Georgia plumped my pillow and straightened my sheet, then hurried off to spread joy elsewhere. I lay still, every cranial vessel throbbing. It had all seemed so real, so vibrant. How much was true? How much a wild opera scripted by the wayward little bubble in my brain? By chemicals roaring through my veins?
Feeling better?
Slidell was again looming, but with a fraction less drama. I gulped the rest of the water, put the cup on the table they'd wheeled to my bedside, sat up and almost gagged. Swallowed.
I called Ryan. He's...
You didn't!
Relax. He wanted to fly straight home, but I talked him down, assured him you're okay.
I need my clothes, I said.
You gotta stay the night. There's a nasty lump on your noggin. Docs think you might have whacked your head and got a concussion.
I'll recover faster at home.
They say at least 24...
I prefer my own bed.
I scored some new intel.
Seriously? What?
You gotta promise to chill till morning. Otherwise, the added stimulation might refry your wiring.
Don't do this, detective.
They're finishing the paperwork to admit you. You'll get oatmeal for breakfast, maybe Jell-O. I think you always get Jell-O.
I glared as hard as I could. Slidell glared back. Since my head was exploding, I cracked first. Besides, I had to admit, checking the state of my lumpy noggin was probably advisable. What's this big breakthrough? Petulant.
Two breakthroughs.
I lifted an impatient palm, noticed my nails were crusted with dirt.
Hevner ran a second broader talk screen.
And shared results with you?
With some persuasion.
Slidell rubbed his jaw, thumb-hooked his pants.
Vodyanov had enough China girl on board to kill half of New Hampshire.
Skinny used one of the many street names for fentanyl, heroin's synthetic cousin, and the gold medalist in the current opioid crisis. A little background. The medical community originally employed fentanyl as an anesthetic, but quickly realized its effectiveness as a painkiller. Always open to innovation, the drug dealer community sat up and took notice. Since fentanyl is 100 times more potent than morphine, many times more so than heroin, why not use the stuff to lower the cost of doing business? Both drugs exist as white powders, Mix in the cheaper, more powerful fentanyl to cut your product and increase supply. Tragically, this entrepreneurial vision proved deadly. Hard fact, 30 milligrams of smack can kill you. With China Girl, it takes only 3. Why the difference? Basic chemistry. Both compounds bind to the mu opioid receptor in the brain. But fentanyl is better at passing through fat, a substance surprisingly plentiful in the head. It arrives faster and, once landed, hugs the receptor so tightly that a minuscule amount triggers the chain of effects so pleasing to the body. End result, fentanyl is now a ruthless predator roaming the streets of America. Too much for my mind to compute at that moment, but the bleak facts were in there, stored from previous headlines and research. Okay, I said. Hevner's got cause. What's she citing as manner?
Undetermined.
There are only 5 choices for manner of death. Homicide, suicide, accidental, natural, undetermined. Based solely on the tox report, I couldn't disagree. I said, it's unlikely Vodyanov hid his car at Arts, hiked out to Buffalo Creek, screwed up, and OD'd.
We can talk about this after you rest.
Now.
Fine.
No argument here, so we're back to square one. The guy probably killed himself, or somebody offed him.
If Vodyanov committed suicide, the question is why. If someone murdered him, the question is who. Also, why? But my thoughts were going muddier with each beep of the monitor.
The other development's no surprise.
I'd forgotten there were 2. Waited.
They ran the prints from your place, focusing on the ones lifted in the 2 studies. Nothing popped. Most were yours, already on file for comparison.
No hits in APHIS?
Local, North Carolina, surrounding states, nothing popped in any system.
The rest will come back as family or friends, maybe my workers.
I'm going to want to talk to those guys.
Right.
And like you said, if it was arson and a B&E, the perp probably wore gloves.
You have to admire proper planning. Slidell ignored that.
The arson guys found no accelerant other than the paint and turpentine, but they found the distribution pattern odd.
Odd.
The stuff was really spread around.
So our perp is probably bad wiring and a careless painter. Did I really think so? What did I believe? 20 minutes later, an orderly rolled me into an elevator, then down a corridor to a room so predictable nothing registered. With his help, I maneuvered the 20-mile gap from the gurney to the bed. A blanket covered me, lights dimmed. Footsteps retreated. Air movement suggested a reangling of the door. Sometime later, tubes rattled and fingers touched my wrist. An IED could have detonated beside me. I would not have reacted. My body was down for the count. Not so my blood or drug-pummeled brain. Sensing an opening, the questions and misgivings re-engaged with undiminished zeal. Image chased image. Some from the inexplicably missing 10 hours. Pulsating walls, a steel tunnel tightening to form a cocoon around me. My fingers searching the inky blackness, desperate for a handle, a lever, a chain. The flesh melting from my hands, baring the bones yellow and raw. Like the bones in the face of the faceless man. Other images sprang from the recent investigation. A trench-coated Vodyanov, a pigtailed Jahan Cole, a gap-toothed Timothy Horshauser, a belligerent Aiello, a shard-covered study, a burned-out office. Had I been targeted? Was I being watched? If so, by whom? Why? What danger did I pose? Did it involve government secrets? Dodgy real estate? Missing kids? Murder? Was the threat a bombshell revelation that Margot Hevner was incompetent or corrupt? Was it Vince Aiello's exposure as a pedophile, Nick Boddy's as a fraud, Vodyanov's as an enabler, a trafficker? The discovery of a killer? or was it all the product of my faulty circuitry? And where did Yates Timmer fit in? 2 weeks had passed since Vodianov's body was found. Slidell and I had zero to show for our investigation. In addition to frustration, I felt terrible guilt. Joe Hawkins had leaked me confidential information. That file may have been viewed, even stolen in the break-in, if there was a break-in. Lizzie Greiser had performed an analysis gratis. Her phenotype report was also destroyed, perhaps viewed or downloaded. Out of some half-baked mistrust of cybersecurity, I'd stored nothing in the cloud. Not a chance Hefner would share her notes, and I wouldn't place Joe at further risk. I could ask Lizzie for another copy of her report, but that might put her in jeopardy. Sudden, frightening possibility. Had Jerry Bruger burgled my home? Had he torched the annex to cover his tracks? To slow me and Slidell in our investigation? Did the reporter want a story that badly? The implications were horrendous. If Bruger made everything public, Joe might be fired, his long career ended in disgrace. Would Lizzie suffer the same fate? Would her employer lose clients due to distrust in the lab's ability to maintain confidentiality? My career was in free fall. Was I dragging my friends down with me? I envisioned radiating circles with me at the epicenter, a ripple effect of destruction created by my actions. Besides hallucinations, could migraines cause panic, paranoia, and feelings of hopelessness? Could the aneurysm or subsequent embolization? Or had I been drugged? Was my heightened anxiety a byproduct of a bad acid or Molly trip? Were my fears justified? Were Slidell and I closing in on someone or something? A long-hidden government secret? A real estate scam? A media fraud? A child molester? A killer? Chapter 27. Friday, July 13th. Hospitals are the least restful places on earth. Nevertheless, I ended up having to stay what remained of that first night and the next. Once my medical history was revealed, my neurologist was notified. He ordered an MRI and MRA, an EEG, and other poking and prodding, just to be sure. Both nights I was awakened repeatedly by a penlight shining in my eyes. Both dawns, some doctor was paged for some color-coded crisis. Constant summonses followed, carts rattled, speakers bonged. At 7 a.m. on Friday, anxious to return home to rescue Birdie from my neighbor Walter's care, I started agitating for release. The wheels ground at the pace of tectonic drift. At 8, I was disengaged from my drip line. At 8:30, breakfast was placed on my over-the-bed table. As on my first morning, no Jell-O. At 9:30, the tray was cleared. I inquired about my belongings, not disclosing my intention to bolt. At 9:40, Ryan walked through the door with a bouquet the size of a Hereford. Mixed feelings flooded through me. Happiness, humiliation, resentment. Wow, was all I could muster. Wow as in good wow, or just shoot me wow? Ryan looked around, finally set the flowers on the windowsill. They were not a good fit. Then he crossed to the bed to kiss me. Of course I'm glad to see you. It's just such a surprise. We'd spoken early Thursday, agreed it was just a bump on the head and that Ryan should remain in France. Staying put didn't work for me. I had to see your smiling face myself. My smiling face did anything but. What about Neville? I asked. I set some things in motion. We'll head back if one of those leads pans out. Big Ryan grin. So, when are you out of here? Any minute. Or we hatch an escape plan. Ryan snapped a salute. I am a police officer. I can condone no illegal maneuver. At 10:30, a plastic bag appeared. T. Brennan, room number 1203, penned in Sharpie on the outside. I loosened the drawstring, was relieved to see my keys tucked into one dirt-crusted sneaker, a silent thank you to Slidell. I was pulling out my jeans when an attending physician appeared, or a hospitalist, maybe a plumber. His name tag said Gersahani. After giving me a cursory once-over and issuing recommendations for my continued well-being, Gersahani informed me that Dr. Bernard, my neurologist, was on his way, and that Bernard would be discharging me. When Gersahani had gone, I glanced over at Ryan, defiant.
"Don't even think about it," he said,
confiscating the bag and dropping into the room's only chair. Arms crossed, I slumped back on my pillows.
"Want to talk about what happened?"
Ryan asked after several moments of silence. "I don't know what happened," I said too snappishly. I wasn't in a chatty mood.
"Fair enough. How about this?"
Gesturing at my eyes.
"Lids down."
"Why?"
"So you can tell me what you remember. It will pass the time while we wait."
After rolling them, I closed my eyes. Given a little encouragement, a bedlam of disconnected scenes fired like tracer rounds in my head, fragmented, disorganized. I sorted briefly, hoping for some semblance of chronology. I was reviewing the Pascarol file when Dorothée appeared and told me I'd made an error.
That must have been unsettling.
"You think?"
Eyes still closed. Dorothée and I drove to the bunker in Cleveland County. Everything was the same, yet exaggerated. The colors too bright, the vegetation too thick and tangled, the heat too oppressive, the shadows too dizzying. It was like picking my way through the frames of an over-colorized film cranking in slow-mo.
"I get it."
Dorothée disappeared through the blast door. Though afraid, I followed. It's hard to explain why. Somehow, I couldn't turn back. It was like I was driven by a need to right my mistake. I paused. Ryan waited. Underground, the darkness was so absolute I had to feel my way by touch. Then, in the distance, I saw this tiny green dot. It seemed to be beckoning, but the more I moved toward it, the farther away it seemed.
"This is making no sense."
"It is."
Again, wiggling a finger at my now open eyes, I complied. I felt my way through inky black tunnels, into open chasms filled with swirling neon light, pulsating walls, and heaving floors and ceilings. I swallowed, nauseated by the recalled tumult. At one point, I was in a passageway, at first doubled over, then crawling on all fours, then curled fetal. The space was shrinking, and I knew I had to get out, or wake up, but I couldn't do either. My lids flew open. I looked at Ryan. I remember thinking it was like being trapped in an upturned tin of snooze.
"Strange thought."
Ryan repeated the finger command. At one point, I saw Jahan Cole, eyes shut. She was talking about her bones, begging me to do something. My gut tightened.
"That's enough,"
I said, weary of spelunking through the nightmare.
"Okay," he said.
20 minutes later, Bernard came smiling in, all morning cheer and bubbly good spirits.
"How is our patient this morning?"
"Ready to split."
"And split you shall. All your results look excellent. The aneurysm is not misbehaving. There is no evidence of a TIA or mini stroke. Nothing unusual turned up in your blood or urine."
"What does that mean?"
"Not much. The symptoms you described, hallucinations, a seemingly out-of-body experience, are consistent with the effects of LSD. But acid wouldn't have been detected by any mainstream drug test, which is all they did in the ER.
I started to interrupt. Bernard ignored me.
"And had you ingested LSD, 50% of the drug would have cleared your body within 5 hours, the remainder within as little as 15.
"I don't do drugs."
"I understand. Not my skill set." Meaningful lifting of brows to me,
then to Ryan. Poisoning? Forget the concussion and the lump. Might the whole thing have been a gorilla of a migraine? I asked.
Unusual, but anything's possible. Did you feel a headache coming on? Had you just taken your current prescription?
I don't recall either.
If it was a migraine, what might have triggered it? Ryan asked.
Bernard shrugged. It's hard to isolate one factor.
This was getting us nowhere. I was anxious to leave. So, swinging my legs over the side of the bed, I'm good to go, right?
Bernard provided discharge advice similar to Gersahani's and took his leave. He'd barely cleared the door when I snatched the bag from Ryan and darted into the bathroom. My clothes hadn't improved during the hours they'd spent bunched like linguine. Scraping off soil and debris as best I could, I dressed. Then I washed my face and scrubbed my nails. My hands tingled. My vision seemed strange as I watched the final remnants of soil swirl down the drain as muddy runoff. While rebinding my hair, I caught sight of myself in the mirror. I couldn't recall ever looking so haggard. My cheeks were hollow, my lower lids baggy, my skin ashen. My hair was a greasy brown coil wrapping my skull. The combination made me look older by at least 10 years. I stared at my face. It stared back. Me, a decade in the future. Did I have a decade? If so, what did it hold? To Ryan's credit, he'd given no indication that I looked so awful. If he did so now, I swore I'd level him, at least metaphorically. Ryan made no comment. Wordlessly, he arm-wrapped my shoulders, collected the bovine flora, and walked me out into the corridor. I declined the mandatory wheelchair ride to the main entrance, a wildly unpopular move. An argument ensued. Catching the orderly's eye, Ryan shook his head subtly while pushing for an elevator. The man backed off. At ground level, Ryan called an Uber. 10 minutes later, I led us into the annex. The Pascarol file was gone from the kitchen table, my shoulder bag from the counter. I found both in the pantry, another wily effort by Skinny. To my horror, my iPhone was not in my purse. Red rocket flare in my chest. I'd never had a chance to forward the pics to Slidell. Not quite accurate, I just hadn't done it. Panicky, I searched everywhere, knowing the reaming I'd endure. Finally gave up, certain it was futile. Ryan had left 3 messages on my landline, the final one at 6 a.m. Thursday morning. Slidell had obviously kept him looped in concerning my disappearance and reemergence. While I listened and deleted, he climbed to assess the damage upstairs. Birdie was as peeved as expected, and ravenous. After issuing double cat rations, I enjoyed a very long, very hot shower. I was taking a lot of those lately. One difference, Ryan slipped in to join me for this one. Helped with the soaping and spraying. Then, thoroughly clean, we retreated to my bed to assess my injuries and remedy my pain. No mixed feelings about that enterprise. Following our thoroughly satisfying romp in the sheets, Ryan napped, exhausted from the long overnight flight. I dug out a mask and gloves and resumed my excavation in the upstairs office. 90 minutes later, I'd confirmed my worst fears. I had nothing to show for all my investigative efforts. A destroyed beyond hope laptop, no mobile, no file, no photos, no notes. Nothing concrete linking Vidyana for anyone in his circle to Jahan Cole, to any missing child. All I retained were the memories assembled in my head. But how reliable were those? Would they filter back warped and twisted through a migraine or drug lens? I am a scientist. I test hypotheses based on items I can observe, measure, weigh, and photograph. I'd been left with none. Could I rely on my stored perceptions? Could I sort what was real from what was not? Test run. I closed my eyes.
experienced another flash flood of psychedelic images. A resurrected murder victim, an azure path, a tiny emerald orb, rainbow madness, airless captivity, a pleading child. Holy shitballs! I rocketed to my bedroom and yanked open the top dresser drawer.
Yes!
Gursahani and Bernard had both recommended against operating a motor vehicle or heavy equipment for a minimum of 48 hours. Out of deference to their training, I allowed Ryan to drive. By 3, we were at UNCC. Though summer session was in full swing, the lawns and walkways were largely deserted. Finding an ace parking spot was freakishly easy. Crossing from the deck to the building housing the bioanthropology lab, we saw no students throwing frisbees to each other or to their dogs, no undergraduates shooting the breeze or hurrying between classes. Here and there, we passed a grad student stooped under the weight of an overloaded backpack, a faculty member lugging a battered briefcase. Most of the latter I knew, some I didn't. One, a physics professor, wished me an uneventful Friday the 13th. The interior of the Friday building was blessedly arctic. We rode the elevator to 4 and I unlocked the door to the lab. After turning on the overheads, I used another key to open a metal cabinet. Ryan settled in a chair and watched silently. I removed a small Dremel cutting tool from the cabinet's top shelf, the kind used by most DNA labs, and grabbed a packet of carborundum sandpaper. Taking my supplies to a workstation, I lifted the protective cover from the microscope, readied a set of glass slides, and sat down. Ryan pulled out his phone and began scrolling. After gloving, I slipped a small Tupperware tub from my purse and removed its single tissue-wrapped item. The slender segment of long bone looked worryingly less substantial than I remembered. Placing the specimen on the scope's platform, I leaned in to the eyepiece. With a few adjustments to lighting and magnification, details snapped into focus. The charring was more superficial than I'd suspected upon first seeing the fragment beside the Cleveland County dumpster. Tooth marks were apparent that hadn't been visible in the dimness under the camo netting. I slid the partial tibia its entire length, millimeter by millimeter, noting details. Then I removed, measured, and photographed it, marveling at my foresight in holding the fragment back from Slidell.
Skinny let you keep that?
Ryan was again watching me.
Not exactly, I said.
Then it was showtime.
After setting several sheets of sandpaper to soak, I inserted a fine-edged blade into the handheld rotary saw. A quick buzz through the middle of the shaft, then I cut a series of vertical slices. Carefully lining them up on a tray, I began polishing each, starting with rough grit, then easing through sheets with finer and finer coarseness. When satisfied that my thin sections were adequately smooth and, well, thin, I inserted the first slide under the lens, set the power to 100 times, and maxed the brightness so light would pass through the specimen.
Explain again what you're looking for.
Ryan had crossed the room to stand behind me. Human cortical bone. The dense part on the outside.
Yes.
It's made up of haversian systems, or osteons, each with a central canal surrounded by concentric layers, or lamellae, of compact bone tissue. When magnified, that's the arrangement. I pointed to a poster hanging on the wall by the door.
Looks like a moonscape of closely packed volcanoes.
Exactly. Ungulate bone, that of hoof-toed mammals, has a plexiform or columnar structure. When magnified, it's more like that, pointing to a second poster.
Looks like layers of sausage with bubbles trapped in and between.
I'd never thought of it that way, but couldn't disagree. Barely breathing, I re-engaged with the eyepiece and fine-tuned the focus.
Crap.
What? Sausage all the way.
Meaning?
Based on estimated size and shape, were the bone complete, I think it belonged to a young Odocoileus virginianus.
Which is?
Bambi.
A white-tailed deer.
I nodded, emotions circling, unsure where to land. Mercifully, the fragment hadn't come from an immature human skeleton.
So it's not a kid, Ryan said.
No, but that's not true of the incisors and molars in the duct tape pouch.
Those teeth definitely came from a child?
Yes.
Damn it to hell. Way too harsh. It's not the end of the world.
Ryan placed a calming hand on my shoulder. But it is. What physical evidence do I have? This fragment was my last hope, and it's from an animal. The human teeth were snatched before I could even take pictures. I photographed the folder and the articles on missing kids, but those images are gone with my laptop.
You have?
I have zero. The lab hummed quietly, the building.
I know what you need, Ryan said, tightening his fingers.
How can you think about sex?
Let's go.
Frustrated, I packed up and we left. And discovered where the entire population of Charlotte was spending its hot and steamy Friday the 13th. Chapter 28. The Apple Store at South Park Mall was elbow to earlobe. Ryan's idea of a cure for my needs, not further afternoon delight. While I was cutting bone, he'd called ahead to the Genius Bar. I gave my name to the lady in the official blue shirt. A screen listed my cue position as 27. That number was called or projected an hour after our arrival. 20 minutes of discussion, then I headed out with a spanking new MacBook Air and the latest model iPhone, each equipped with every innovation known to the cyber mind.
God bless credit cards.
Back home, with phone coaching from Apple support and from Ryan, I downloaded all the old files and photos I had stored in the cloud, most of which were personal, and reinstalled several essential apps. Then I initiated my new phone, which deactivated the old one. 2 hours after starting, woefully lacking in content but functional, I was good to go. The onward march of civilization. First off, I left a message for Slidell. I am home. I have news. Call me.
Now, Ryan encouraged, open a new dossier on the faceless man.
What's the point? Sounding like a sulky kid. I've got nothing to put in it.
Yes, you do. I just looked at him. Enter everything that's in your head.
Grudgingly, I had to admit the logic of his suggestion, but not out loud. What will you do? I asked.
I have a long list of calls to make. To a man about a horse? Something like that.
I opened a blank document on the laptop, titled it Timeline. Then, working from memory, I began entering data. Timeline. June 22nd, midnight. Temperance Brennan observes a trench-coated man at Sharon Hall. June 29th. An anonymous source texts Brennan images of a Cleveland County corpse. June 30th. Brennan reviews her criticism of Margot Hevner. Hevner calls a press conference ME-304-18, the faceless man from Cleveland County, erroneously suggests ME-304-18 is of Asian ancestry. Brennan takes pics and a DNA sample from ME-304-18. Joe Hawkins provides Brennan photocopies of docs. Lizzie Greiser agrees to perform an off-the-books phenotype analysis of ME-304-18. July 1st. Brennan finds errors in Hevner's notes, age, ancestry, observes bruising on corpse missed by Hevner. Brennan deciphers coded note found on ME-304-18. July 2nd. Brennan learns that back of scrap found on faceless man has reference to sinking of ferry Estonia / biochemical weapons. Skinny Slidell and Brennan find Hyundai at Art's Affordable Garage near Creek where ME-304-18 was discovered, duffel in trunk. Duffel contains A. More Russian and Latvian notations, some regarding Estonia / biochemical weapons. B. names Felix Vodyanov and John Ito. C. Thumb drive labeled in Russian. Slidell determines John Ito is an alias. Hyundai registered to non-existent West Virginia address. Slidell spots indented writing, delivers torn page to Mitty Peppers at CMPD Forensics Lab for QD analysis. Analysis reveals A. Brennan mobile phone number. B. Second phone number, local 704. C. Reference to missing child Jahan Cole. Brennan and Slidell determined Vodyanov had tried to contact Brennan shortly before his death. July 6th. Brennan and Slidell learn Vodyanov is absent from all databases, has zero profile on internet. Brennan gets phenotype sketch from Greiser. Slidell obtains name of physician and ashram from thumb drive. Slidell and Brennan go to Sparkling Waters Ashram. Aryan Yuryev is uncooperative. Receptionist E. Desai IDs Vodyanov from sketch, says Vodyanov was registered under name F. Vance. Brennan interviews Vodyanov Vance caretaker, Asia Barrow. Barrow says Vodyanov Vance suffered from taphophobia. Barrow reveals Vodyanov Vance researched kiddie porn, missing kids using her laptop. Barrow says Vodyanov was a Russian operative. Brennan interviews Vodyanov Vance landlady, Marguerite Ramos. Ramos IDs Vodyanov Vance, says he was terrified government was out to kill him. July 7th. Brennan finds items in coat taken from antiseptically clean Vodyanov Vance apartment. List of codes, info on Project MK Ultra, receipt that leads to fenced Cleveland County property. Brennan goes to property, unable to enter. Brennan interviews neighbor, Duncan Kiesing. Kiesing IDs Vodyanov, says he was crazy. Says when high, Vodyanov talked about MK Ultra, other covert ops. Kiesing witnessed frightened child being driven onto fenced property. Brennan learns more about MK Ultra from Andrew Ryan. Brennan emails Hevner. Brennan visits websites, reads body conspiracy theory blogs, listens to podcasts. July 8th. Brennan visits Deep Dark Web. Site Deep Under. A. Old info and photos about conspiracy theories. B. Photo of Vodyanov with body and Yates Timmer. Brennan visits site Homes at the End of the World. Brennan returns to fenced property, finds A. File with clippings about missing kids. B. Reference to Deep Haven, pic viewed later. C. Child dentition. D. Bone fragments. Attacked. Slidell runs name Holly Kimry. Sex trade, drug dealer. July 9th. Brennan and Slidell go to Deep Haven, Lake Wiley. Realtor office slash club. Meet Bing Timmer. Learn A. Felix Vodyanov is older brother of Nick Boddy. B. Vodyanov fought with Vince Aiello, a.k.a. Twist, was banned from Deep Haven. C. Aiello has reputation for kiddie porn. July 10th. Fire at Brennan condo. B&E. Arson. Accidental. Laptop and all materials pertaining to Vodyanov investigation destroyed. July 11th. Slidell interrogates Aiello, patent attorney with two kiddie porn busts. Aiello says Vodyanov, A, was paranoid. B, accused him of kidnapping and killing kids, suddenly dropped allegations. C, resumed stalking him shortly before his death. Brennan has migraine or is poisoned slash drugged and disappears for 10 hours. July 12th. Hevner tells Slidell that Vodyanov died of fentanyl overdose. July 13th. Brennan makes thin sections from bone fragment found at fenced property slash bunker in Cleveland County. Deer bone. I scanned the timeline. Mostly, it reflected my actions and those of Slidell. Lots of digging, little result. Ryan returned to find me slumped back, frowning at the screen. At his prompting, I explained my frustration.
"Try a new angle," he suggested.
"Such as?"
"Retrace the movements of your faceless man. Track what Vodyanov did in the weeks leading up to his death."
"Sadly, I know very little."
"Hit me with it."
According to Asia Barrow, Vodyanov had repeatedly checked into sparkling waters because of stress related to taphophobia, was discharged for the final time in late May or early June. Something niggled at a corner of my brain.
What?
I tried to pry the thought loose. It wouldn't budge. I continued. According to Vince Aiello, Vodyanov's stalking resumed in late May or early June, continued over the next several weeks.
Coincidence?
I shrugged. Who knows?
Go on.
According to Bing, Vodyanov and Aiello had their fight at Deep Haven on June 20th. I spotted Vodyanov skulking around Sharon Hall on June 22nd. He was dead of a fentanyl overdose by June 29th. We both considered the dates, looking for a pattern. Ryan spoke first. After leaving the ashram, Vodyanov repeatedly tried to connect with Vince Aiello, resumed harassing him for information on missing kids.
Yes, and Vodyanov was also watching me.
Why?
To share intel, ask for intel?
Concerning? No idea.
What could have triggered Vodyanov's desire to contact a forensic anthropologist and a patent lawyer with a taste for child porn? Might something have happened during his last day at Sparkling Waters?
Felix Vodyanov was Nick Boddy's older brother, I said, having no answer to Ryan's question.
Nick Boddy, the egomaniacal provocateur?
Yes. New angle, how about we take a look at Boddy? We revisited the timeline, found not the slightest hint to the whereabouts or actions of Vodyanov's younger sibling. I sat back thinking about that, about the hours of digging that Slidell and I had done. Was I wearing blinders? Was I missing one big-ass Exhibit A? I was defining evidence as that which I had, that which I'd lost, objects, images. But what about all those tiny facts bearing witness to a life? The personal minutiae stored in millions of archives in dozens of countries. Vodyanov left virtually no internet footprint, I said. Slidell and I both researched the guy. He wasn't in any database.
Little brother?
Same story. Boddy has a public profile. Still, he managed to keep his private life hidden. In today's interconnected, digitized world, that kind of anonymity is almost impossible.
Realization. The absence of data can be as important as that which is present. The absence is evidence.
I straightened in my chair and tapped the space bar.
Going to have another go at him?
I nodded. First off, I spent a little more time at Boddy language. What the hell? I'd already forked over the fee. Boddy was as nauseating as I recalled. I was switching from a rant on fraudulent voting in the last election to one suggesting that the recent wildfires in California were the result of a government conspiracy to clear land for a rapid transit system when my new phone chimed an incoming call. Chapter 29.
Where the hell have you been?
They didn't serve Jell-O.
For shit's sake. For once, can't you just chill?
Slidell's voice sounded like battery acid burning through rust. The stress and fatigue told me he'd been up all night. Yes, I am feeling better. Thanks for asking. My eyes met Ryan's. I mouthed the name Slidell. He gestured that he was going back upstairs and waggled his phone. I nodded.
Ryan, get in okay?
Yes. I bought a new mobile and laptop. Reporting my histology caper would have required a confession of withholding half the bone fragment. No way.
You lost your phone?
Or someone took it. It was missing from my purse. Thanks for stowing that and the file, by the way, and for bringing my keys to the hospital.
Looks like some asshat maybe did torture place.
I didn't interrupt.
CSU lifted one print, had no business being there.
Where?
Ledge outside the kitchen window.
You got a hit?
Holly Kimry.
No shit.
No shit.
Have you found him?
We will. If the little cretin did set that fire, we're talking B&E, arson, assault, maybe manslaughter, attempted murder.
I doubt anyone wanted to kill me.
You know where you were those 10 hours?
I didn't. Were you able to test the sun tea?
The jar was in the sink. You probably poured or spilled the stuff down the drain, so that won't be happening.
Are you questioning Kimry's associates, other dealers, sex workers?
I don't know how I'd do this job without you.
A small, tired pause, then.
We're poking down every hole, hooking every snake squirms up.
How can someone just vanish like that?
You managed.
If Kimry did bust into my place, torch it, I doubt he was acting on his own. Who do you suppose directed him?
Can't say. But I can say the little turd links to that bunker you're so hot to toss.
Maybe did toss? I couldn't be sure. Had I actually gone there? Or were my memories fantasies spawned by my own rebellious blood? By a bad acid trip?
Kimry mugs you in the boonies. Now his print turns up at your crib.
Slidell was still talking.
Might be enough for a warrant.
Have you determined who owns the fenced property?
We're working on it. Look, I'm not sitting with my thumb up my ass. While you were sleeping off your concussion,
maybe concussion,
or Lucy in the Sky jaunt, I did follow-ups with some of your other pals. Marguerite Ramos ain't getting my vote for Citizen of the Year.
You talked to Ramos again?
That about sums it up. I talked to her. This time, she barely said shit.
I may have loosened her tongue by implying I might alert ICE. I still wasn't proud of that.
Gee, I'd never think of something so devious.
I held back a retort.
Ramos says the guy in number 6 was named Vance. That Vance was a sterling tenant. Then he moved on. She thinks maybe Slovakia. She never heard of Felix Vodianov.
She told me she spoke to Vodianov several times, overheard him on the phone. She said Vodianov was afraid for his life.
All of which I stated to jog her recall. Seems the Signora's memory is no longer so bueno.
Why the about face?
It gets better. I drove to Mooresville to see Barrow.
She was more forthcoming with me than Ramos.
It appears Nurse Ratchet is seeking broader horizons.
She's stonewalled, too? Not mentioning that Asia Barrow wasn't a nurse.
The house was boarded up, the generator off, the truck nowhere to be seen.
Barrow is gone?
Yep.
Did you question her cousin? This was making no sense. The receptionist at the ashram?
E. Desai quit her job last Tuesday. Called it in.
Why?
Personal reasons. FYI, the E stands for Eunice. Also, FYI, the new receptionist makes Eunice look like Alfred Einstein.
Did you question Yuryev?
Again, not bothering to correct, Slidell. The good doctor wasn't there, but he's topping my agenda.
The ashram must have contact information in Desai's personnel file.
Eunice lives alone in Winston-Salem, has for 4 years. Or had. The landlord wasn't thrilled to see she'd packed up and split without notice.
I started to interrupt. Slidell rolled on. Her cell phone was also disconnected. On Tuesday, the day she resigned. Jesus Christ. Sirens were rising in my head. So Ramos isn't talking, and Kimry, Barrow, and Desai are in the wind.
Yep.
Slidell's fallback when frustrated. Barrow was renting that house, said she didn't like being tethered. Maybe she and her cousin just decided to move on. Slidell said nothing. Or maybe something spooked them.
Thought crossed my mind.
Have you talked to Yates Timmer? Nick Boddy?
My other headliners, right behind Yuryev.
You could go back to Duncan Kiesing. He's the disabled vet who lives down the road.
He's okay.
You saw Kiesing?
He claims to know nothing about Vodyanov beyond what he told you, zip about Boddy, says he's never heard of Yates Timmer. I believe him.
Guilt pulled like undertow in my chest. The possibility of attacks against me had spurred Slidell more than I'd realized. He was pushing hard. Now what? I asked, tone gentler.
You said you had news.
Have you gotten DNA results on the bone I liberated from the raccoon? I asked, voice carefully neutral.
What dream you living in?
The more I think about it, visualize it, the more I doubt that fragment is human.
Don't matter. We'll have colonies on the moon before we get a report.
Any developments on Jahan Cole? There was silence, followed by a sigh.
Nope.
You'll keep me looped in about the warrant?
Yep.
Is that a yes?
Promise one thing, Doc.
I said nothing.
Stay busy doodling Ryan until you hear from me.
A good doodle didn't sound all that bad. Certainly kept Mama purring along. But Ryan had his own worries, was now cloistered in the bedroom with his laptop. No hard copy files, no stored images or documents, no physical evidence. Cut off from most witnesses.
Yep.
I fed the cat and returned to my groovy new Mac. After logging back on, I downloaded the Tor browser and nosedived into the dark web. No surprise, I was still blocked from deep under. I dredged for a while, netted nothing new on Yates Timmer, nothing at all on Nick Boddy. Who was this arrogant loudmouth who always hid in the shadows? I decided to resurface and spend time listening to Boddy's podcasts and reading his blogs. Some of his rants were more toxic than I'd imagined. Over the past decade, Boddy had been particularly vehement on two themes. Plots involving kids, plots involving medical wrongdoing. Occasionally, his insane theories managed to combine both elements. I began with titles suggesting misconduct through manipulation of public health. There were numerous variations on the evils of vaccination. In the old tried and true, Boddy alleged that vaccination causes autism. In a somewhat more creative twist, he argued that Bill Gates was behind a plot to use immunization for population control. In another series of tirades, he insisted that the government was sneaking RFID chips into children via inoculation. Many of Boddy's harangues focused on disease. Over and over, he returned to the theme of government conspiracy. A sampling, he claimed that the Ebola epidemic in West Africa was a biological weapons test performed by America. That SARS was a germ attack against the Chinese. That AIDS was created and distributed by those in power in the U.S. That the anthrax attacks following 9/11 were orchestrated by the government. That banning DDT was a scheme to depopulate the earth by spreading malaria. That Huntington's disease is caused by a microbe, and the government is conspiring to suppress a known cure. And my personal favorite, that chemtrails are responsible for mad cow outbreaks. Ryan popped in now and then to ask how I was, to offer a drink or a back rub, to say he was sallying forth to forage for a late dinner. By the time I sat back, the windows were dark and my stomach was growling. I cruised through the annex, checking security and turning on lights, was just finishing when Ryan returned bearing pizza. Birdie joined us as I made the first cut. I gave him a tiny slice, Ryan and myself large ones. As we chewed pie and slurped cheese, I shared snippets of what I'd read and heard. Boddy's theories are absurd, his arguments laughably devoid of accurate detail or plausible evidence. My critique.
Your personal faves?
I provided a half dozen ludicrous examples.
The guy's got millions of loyal followers.
Sadly, that may be true, and the credulous chumps aren't laughing. What kept you so busy today?
Got a tip that Neville
is on his way to Marseille. You're guessing the horse didn't book his own passage?
Doubtful.
I appreciate you making such a long trip, Ryan, but you really don't need to stay here with me. I want to be sure you're fully sound before hitting the road. Has that ever been the case? Ryan waggled a hand, maybe yes, maybe no. I'm cool, I said, smiling.
A merry prankster.
Riding the bus, acknowledging Ryan's Ken Kesey reference.
Seriously, how are you feeling?
Perfectly chipper. It was true. Though I should have been exhausted, I felt oddly energized. A byproduct of the concussion? Of meds I was given at the hospital? Of drug-laced tea?
Skinny was crazy until you turned up.
He's busting ass to determine what happened here. Did he tell you CSU found a print outside the kitchen window?
I haven't spoken to Slidell today.
I briefed Ryan on Holly Kimry. Was concluding when his mobile buzzed.
Do you mind if I take this?
Of course not, and please go ahead and make flight reservations if necessary. I really am fine. Still too jazzed for sleep or doodling, I returned to my Mac and endured a second round of body, this time focusing on his other favorite theme, plots involving children. Some theories had been around for decades. Kids were being kidnapped and killed for their organs, a valuable commodity in a global black market. Kids were being kidnapped and sold as sex slaves, domestic workers, farm laborers. Kids were being kidnapped for sacrifice and satanic rituals. Kids were being kidnapped for use in mind control experiments run by the CIA. Many theories were new, some so outlandish it was incredible that even the most gullible could buy in. Kids were being kidnapped and transported to work camps built by NASA on Mars. Kids were being kidnapped and taken to concentration camps set up by FEMA in preparation for the imposition of martial law and the killing of millions of Americans. Kids were being kidnapped and flown to Jonestown, the abandoned camp in Guyana, where Jim Jones and members of his People's Temple committed mass suicide. Though the experience was loathsome, I learned one thing, perhaps useful, perhaps not. Margot Hevner's betrayal of Hardin Symes was not an isolated instance of indiscretion. Dr. Morgue's interview was one of many during a particularly virulent 2-year period in which bodies seemed fixated on the topic of murdered and missing kids. And he didn't hold back. Who? Where? When? Some cases I knew, others I didn't. Podcast after podcast, blog after blog, always the same message, like a rabid zealot. Body spewed conspiracy hokum, warning parents of the dangers of losing their children. By 2 a.m., I'd had it. Disgusted, I closed my laptop. Birdie and Ryan were already curled together in bed. I joined them and closed my eyes, at last mentally and physically drained. Still, Body's voice jackhammered through the fatigue. Names: Hardin Symes, Jahan Cole, Timothy Horshauser. Images: young faces in grainy print, a neon pink sneaker deep in a dumpster, milky white teeth in a duct tape pouch. Questions fluttered like the moths that circled my porch light. A coded reference to Jahan Cole in Vodyanov's notebook. Why? Articles on Jahan Cole and Timothy Horshauser at the fenced property. Why? Body raging on body language, inciting fear about kids, kindling parental paranoia. Why? I sat up in the dark. Could that be it? The notion was so wild, it needed a cage. I hurried back to the kitchen and reopened my Mac. By dawn, I was certain the pattern was real, and horrified it might confirm my suspicion. Chapter 30. Saturday, July 14th. Slidell was in my kitchen by 8:45. I walked him and Ryan through it. You're both familiar with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, right?
Their site posts info on missing kids.
Slidell's face looked like jumbled laundry waiting to be washed. I nodded. Namus?
Same deal.
Doesn't Namus also list unidentified remains?
Ryan asked. Yes. So searchers can try to put names to unknown corpses.
Jahan Cole's on both, Slidell said. So what?
And there are many other organizations, some regional, some national, I added.
Look, I've been all over.
I spent several hours checking stats, plotting child disappearances by date, by locale, and so on. I also did an analysis of bodies' podcasts and blogs by topic, by air date, and so on. Then I did some cross-tabulation.
How could you stomach listening to that douchebag?
Fortitude. And a tanker truck of coffee. From 2012 to 2014, Body was obsessed with the topic of missing and murdered children. I could give you the daily breakdown, but for now, trust me.
Where are you going with this?
Slidell didn't try to mask his impatience, at least not effectively. From 2012 to 2014, Amber Alerts and other reports of missing kids rose sharply in some areas.
The guy plays off paranoia, Ryan said.
His harangues both followed and preceded the disappearances.
You suggesting Body goaded his listeners into snatching kids?
Slidell couldn't have sounded more dubious. Hear me out. The laundry rearranged slightly, but Skinny held his tongue. I also tabulated child disappearances by geography and by year. I also relied on the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. During a period Body was pushing conspiracy theories involving kids, most states maintained typical numbers for Amber Alerts, child homicides, MPs. In only two did those numbers rise sharply. I slid a paper across the table so both men could see. West Virginia and North Carolina. Four eyes dropped to the printout, skimmed the heartbreaking catalog of names, rolled up.
What are you saying? Slidell.
Jahan Cole disappeared during a time Body was hammering on about kids being targeted. Timothy Horshauser, the others on that list. Children who vanished, never to be found.
Didn't you say Horshauser lived in Pennsylvania?
Ryan. Uniontown is just 30 miles up the road from Morgantown, West Virginia. Ryan grasped it immediately.
Budyanov registered his Hyundai in Morgantown under the alias John Ito. He was living in Charlotte under the name F. Vance. He links to both places.
He had Jahan Cole's name in his notebook. Slidell chest-crossed his arms, listening. I found baby teeth at the fenced property in Cleveland County, articles on Cole and Horshauser. I photographed a child's sneaker in the dumpster.
You making a point or just doing a recap?
Slidell, sharp. We know Vodyanov was working for his brother.
So?
I swallowed. What I was about to say was almost too appalling for words. What if Body had Vodyanov grabbing kids to scare the crap out of people? To create an atmosphere of fear and drive followers to body language?
That's pretty extreme.
Ryan, far more diplomatic than Slidell. I'm just putting it out there. Child disappearances spiked in only two states out of 50 during the period Body was raging on the topic. The very states associated with Vodyanov and his brother. Our eyes met. Ryan's ice blue and troubled, Slidell's red-rimmed and bleary. A beat, then Skinny's gaze returned to the page before him.
I remember most of these North Carolina alerts coming across the wire. West Virginia's off the patch. I'll float queries, try to contact the lead in each case.
What happened with the warrant? I asked.
Still a non-starter. Judge says all I'm arguing is a dead guy, and a place makes me nervous.
Are you kidding? Kimry jumped me.
Outside the gate. She needs stronger evidence suggesting criminal activity on the property. Of course, I can't mention nothing you got inside the gate, it being from an illegal entry and all.
Any word on who holds title?
Expecting that any minute.
Slidell rose with a slowness that bore witness to his exhaustion.
Had one amusing moment yesterday.
I waited, far from amused.
Got a call from Cootie Clanahan.
Jahan Cole's elderly neighbor,
I explained to Ryan.
Cootie's been devoting serious thought to my queries, recalls one detail about the hinky cop banged on her door this spring. She says the guy spoke with an accent, suspects Swedish, maybe Norwegian.
Russian? Slidell shrugged. You think it could have been Vodyanov?
He tailed you and Vince Aiello just before he died.
Why approach Cole's neighbor?
Slidell shrugged again, a sluggish levering up of one shoulder. I've printed a new copy of Lizzie's phenotype sketch. You could show it to Cootie, see if she can ID him, I suggested.
After I look into these kids.
When frustrated, I am harsh in my self-appraisal. Following Slidell's departure, I sat a while, constructing a mental register of all the ways I'd botched the investigation. Another of all the things I'd done to bring disaster down on myself, feeling like a loser. Ryan went off, returned some time later, and resumed his place in the chair beside mine. For a few seconds I felt his eyes on my face, then he leaned very, very close and spoke in hushed tones, almost a whisper.
Anything I can do to cheer you up?
I felt his lips brush my ear, the heat of his body tight to mine.
Tempting offer.
My voice felt thick in my throat.
But I need to stay focused.
Ryan raised his brows and flicked his naughty choir boy smile. I pressed a palm to his chest. The electricity sizzled between us. I didn't push him away.
I'll be leaving soon, he purred. Ah, Jesus, Ryan.
He took both my hands in his and pulled me to my feet, released one and unbuttoned the top two buttons of my shirt.
You are a terrible influence.
A tiny smile lifting the corners of my mouth. I undid the next two. We scampered upstairs. Our little dance in the sheets forced the negativity to run for cover. Once again dressed and back at my laptop, I was able to think more logically. In my heart, I knew everything came back to the fenced property, that it was critical to gain legal access. Ryan stayed upstairs to pursue whatever lead he'd kicked loose regarding his purloined pony. Unsure what tidbit would ring his or her honor's bell, I opened a blank document and entered every detail I could recall from every interview I'd conducted or witnessed. Desai, Yuryev, Barrow, Ramos, Kiesing, Bing, Aiello. Then I went back over my notes, twice. The second time through, I paused on Duncan Kiesing. Kiesing witnessed a frightened child being driven onto the fenced property. When was that? Did the date track with the disappearance of any child on my list? If I could show a correlation, might that be the judge's smoking gun? When questioned by Slidell, Kiesing had denied further knowledge of Vodyanov. Drive back out to Cleveland County? When Harry and I were kids, we spent hours alone together, especially when Mama was having one of her bad days. Sequestered in the secret clubhouse cubby off our bedroom, we'd play mind games, taking turns creating long sequences of memory challenges, strings of words, numerals, names of states or vegetables, then presenting the list for the other to recite back, blind. Points for accuracy, points for speed. I closed my eyes as I had long ago in that tiny closet, visualized Kiesing's phone, the numbers jotted on the lid. Thanks to all those years of practice, the area code was easy. Ditto the exchange. The next three digits, because they formed a pattern, 2, 4, 6. Try as I might, the last numeral eluded me. I punched in a 10-digit combo, got a woman named Tammy. I tried again, got voicemail for Bill and Irene. On my fifth attempt, a man answered.
Yeah.
Startled, maybe alarmed. Duncan Kiesing?
Who's this?
It's Temperance Brennan. I stopped by to see you last Saturday.
How'd you get this number?
You showed it to me. True, indirectly. Remember? You said it was your SOS line?
Didn't figure you'd be calling it.
I hope this isn't a bad time.
Don't know there's ever a good time for bad news.
Oh, no, sir. This isn't bad news. I just wondered if I could ask...